Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Psalm 2. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one who enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him.
Good evening, 5 p.m. church. How are we doing today? Excellent, excellent. Okay, I want you to do a little bit of work just to start with. The person next to you, I want you to ask them what is their favorite ever song and why. Okay, if favorite's too much pressure, one of your top three, favorite song, why it is. You've got 30 seconds, go. Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one. Okay, that's enough hard work. Anyone want to shout out what the other person said their favorite song was? Hannah Montana? Star Spangled Banner? What? Someone else? The Piano Man. Okay, Billy Joel, good. September, the Trolls version. Okay, all right. Thank you for doing that little bit of work. Here is one of my favourite songs. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. All right, we better stop it there or there's going to be a sing-along. Okay, everybody calm down. Now, I love that song, partly because our whole family loved the movie that it came from. I love the language that it uses, equating happiness as being like in a room without a roof. Like, doesn't make any sense, but it kind of works, right? I love the way that that song makes my family and I feel when we're in the car and it comes on. We all kind of start doing what some of us did. We start bopping away. And I love the topic that it's about, feeling happy. And songs are like that. They can express what we feel, or what we would like to feel. They can move us. They can move us to joy. They can move us to tears. They can bring back memories. They can unite us. I'll never forget being in the swimming stand at the 2000 Paralympics, and the swimming centre was chock-a-block, and spontaneously Waltzing Matilda broke out amongst the crowd, and everybody joined in and raised the roof of that place. It was spine-tingling. It was amazing. Songs can be like that. Now, today, we start a new teaching series called Life Lyrics. And over the next little while, we're going to be looking at the Psalms. Now, there are 150 Psalms, so we should be done by about the year 2020. That should be fine. But all of the Psalms, they're all poems. Many of them started out as songs, and songs that expressed all sorts of emotions about all sorts of situations in life. Songs that celebrated how good God is, and songs that asked where God was when it hurts. So these songs have much to teach us about God and about what the life lived trusting in God looks like. Now, I've always liked music. When I was growing up, I used to buy lots and lots of CDs, would play them in my room. Now, I love when music went to streaming and you could choose from a massive buffet of songs and you could create your own playlist. You can pick songs, you can choose what order they go in, you can give the playlist a title. These are my pump-up songs, or these are my car driving songs. My kids dread when I put Dad driving playlist on, because they know it's all going to be from the 80s and 90s. But that idea is exactly what's happened with the Psalms. See, there were all these songs that were used in the life of Israel. They were sung in the temple. They were sung at festivals. And at one point, after the exile, after the most catastrophic event in Israel's history, where they'd been ripped out of their homes, they'd been ripped out of the temple where they could worship God, ripped out of the promised land, after that point, in the days after the exile, somebody compiled a playlist of Israel's greatest hits and put them together in such a way, in such an order, to help God's people remember why that had happened in the first place and what God was going to do about it into the future. And when they put this playlist together, they started the playlist off with a heading, with a way of understanding what the whole playlist was about. And that heading to the playlist is Psalms 1 and 2 that we just heard read for us. And the funny thing is, the topic of those two psalms is the same as Pharrell's song. It's about happiness. Or more pointedly, it's about how to be happy. The first word of the first psalm in the whole book of Psalms is blessed, which can be translated better here, happy. Happy is the one who. And I can't think of a more relevant topic for us living in our world today than to think about how we can be happy, because we all want to be happy. We all would like others to be happy. We're all pursuing happiness at one level or another. The most sung song in the world is about being happy. And it's really about someone else being happy, because that's all the song says. It's happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. I mean, have a happy birthday. We really want you to have a happy birthday. Okay? But being happy seems to be becoming harder and harder. If you look at the stats, we've talked about these sorts of things before, so I won't go into detail now, but loneliness is on the rise, particularly in wealthy Sydney. Depression and other mental illnesses are on the rise, particularly in wealthy countries and wealthy places like Sydney. I'm not sure many of us can sing with Pharrell Williams, "Bring me down? Can't nothing bring me down, because my level's too high. to bring me down. Can't nothing bring me down. I'm sure that's how he meant it to be read. Now, there are lots of suggestions out there about how we can get happiness, how we can grab hold of this elusive happiness and keep it. One article that I read this week from the Psychology Today journal gave a list. 23 things you should be doing to be happy. You want to hear it? Find out what to do first. Give yourself a confidence boost. Fuel your progress by learning how to feel better about yourself. Create balance and overcome burnout. Build growth mindset for happiness. Make positive memories. Find those silver linings. Take breaks from social media. Spend smarter for more happiness. Communicate kindly. End your negative patterns of thinking. Find clarity. Live your values. Pay attention to the good. Use your imagination to create the life you seek. Stay mindful. Explore what happiness means to you. That's why we're reading the article. But anyway, go ahead, go after life. Speak up and be yourself. Find your purpose. Build meaningful connections. Get off the hedonic treadmill. And hold yourself accountable. That's exhausting. Psalm 1 and 2 have just two things to say about how to be happy. What not to do and what we should do. So let's have a look at those in turn. How to be happy, part one, what not to do. Have you ever noticed that these days instructions for things now come with what not to do? I noticed this when I was setting up the latest piece from IKEA. It doesn't just tell you, and it's glad that I have that because otherwise this is what I would do. But this is how the psalm begins. Psalm 1 verse 1, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers. The psalmist says, if you want to be happy, don't do this. And there's a progression to what he's saying. He says, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked. To walk in step is to start thinking like the people who don't know God. It's to start entertaining their ideas. But it goes one step further. Blessed is the one who doesn't stand in the way. Stand in the way is a Hebrew way of saying you're going to start acting like they act. And then the final step, blessed is the one who doesn't sit in the company of mockers. That's not only to reject God for yourself, but it's also to make fun of anyone else who doesn't agree with you. And you only need to spend 5 minutes on social media, visit sites like John Dixon's site to see examples of people like that abound in this world. So basically, the psalmist is telling us that the road to happiness is not to get in deep with the people who don't know God. Don't think like they think. Don't act like they act. Don't mock like they mock. And we might get that at one level, sure, that sort of understand that sort of advice, but then you ask, really, is that it? If you're going to put together a whole huge work like the Psalms, is that really the life-changing advice that you'd start with? Why is that such a big deal? Well, this is where it's helpful for us to see that Psalm 1 and 2 are meant to be read together. Both of those things are the heading to the book of the Psalms. And as Psalm 2 opens, it shows us why it's a big deal not to walk in the way of these people. Psalm 2 verse 1, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. These first verses of Psalm 2 show us the logical place where the way of the wicked ends up. That way ends up with the wicked people banding together, shaking their fist at God and rejecting his right to rule over them. In verse 3, the word we have that's translated chains there is better translated as yoke. And in the ancient world, the yoke was a symbol of ownership. These people are saying they want to throw off the yoke. They're saying, we don't want to acknowledge that God owns us. We don't want God in our life. These people want to say, I am my own person. No one has the right to tell me what to do, let alone God. No one has the right to tell me what to do with my money, what to do with my time, what to do with my body, what to do with my relationships. That's where the way of the wicked ends up. And as Psalm 2 continues, we get two reasons from the psalmist why that response to God is a really big problem. The first reason it's a problem is that it's foolish. Psalm 2 verse 4, the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. The mismatch of power in this scenario is so extreme that the only response God has is to laugh. It's like an elephant. It's like an ant trying to take on an elephant. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's delusional. Psalm 14 verse 1 later tells us, the fool says in his heart, there is no God, I own myself. It's a problem because it's foolish, but secondly, it's more than foolish. It's more than just a joke. It's deadly. Psalm 2 and verse 5 and 6, the one enthroned in heaven rebukes them in his anger. He terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I've installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. And at that point, we might say, hang on. Why is God getting angry about this? Why would God get angry at people, ants, shaking their fist at him? Isn't God supposed to be a God of love? Well, God Almighty gets angry at that fist waving because it's unjust. That is, it's out of alignment with what's real. It's out of alignment with what's right. What's real and what is right is that there is only one fit to rule. There is only one fit to determine what is right and wrong for humanity, and there is only one who is fit to judge humanity in accordance with what is right and wrong. And that person is not any of us. That person is the king that God has installed on his throne. And the king here in Psalm 2 is intimately tied to God. So that to reject the king is to reject God. Now, in the original context of the psalm, this psalm was probably referring to David. It was a coronation psalm. It was what was said or sung when David took the throne and the kings after David took the throne. But the language is so extreme here. It never fitted David. It never fitted any of the human kings who came after. Look what's said about the king in the verses that come next in Psalm 2, verse 7. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, this is the voice of the king speaking now. He said to me, the me is the voice of the king, you are my son. This is God talking to the king. You are my son. Today, I've become your father. Ask me and I'll make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You'll break them with a rod of iron, a scepter of iron. You'll dash them to pieces like pottery. That's a picture of judging over all the earth that belongs to him. This language is so extreme, it could never be a human king. So who is it? Who is the king who is so tight with God that to reject the king is to reject God and so fall under the judgment of God? Well, the readers for Psalms for many, many years wondered who this figure could be. But we don't have to guess. Jesus said in John 5 and verse 22, moreover, the Father judges no one, but he's entrusted all judgment to the Son, that he all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. And whoever does not honor the Son, the King, does not honor the Father, the one enthroned in heaven, who sent him. And in the book of Acts, we're left in no doubt that it's Jesus who's been installed as the Psalm 2 King through his resurrection of the dead. Acts 13 and verse 32, Peter says, "We tell you the good news. What God promised our ancestors in Psalm 2, he's fulfilled for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. As it is written in the second Psalm, 'You are my son, today I have become your father.'" And so what this means, all of this, is that people's attitude to Jesus is not a side issue in life. It's not a trivial thing. It's not just another box to tick on a form or a little thing to put in your Insta profile. It's the defining issue. It is front and center. Could not be more important. The psalmist says, "It will determine the worth of the life you live now." Come back with me to Psalm 1, verse 4. He's contrasting the way of the righteous with the wicked. He says, "Not so the wicked. They're like chaff that the wind blows away." And we're not farming types, most of us here. Chaff is the dead husk that is around the seed. So after you harvest something like wheat, it gets threshed and the chaff falls off the seed. You take the seed, you mill it up, you make bread or whatever with it, and what you got left is chaff. It's light, it's weightless, it's lifeless, it's useless, and it's worthless. That is the way of those who reject the Son. But it's not just in this life that it has catastrophic consequences. According to the psalmist, your attitude to the Psalm 2 King will determine where life ends up. In Psalm 1 verse 5, "Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous." Psalm 2 verse 12, "Kiss the Son or he'll be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction, for his wrath can flare up in a moment." And John's gospel says exactly the same thing about how the attitude to the Son, the attitude to God's King that he's installed, affects our eternity. John 3 verse 17, "God didn't send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already, because they have not believed in the name of God's one and only Son." Do you want to live a life of happiness? "Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers." So that's what not to do. That's the first thing the psalmist wants us to see. Don't do that. But there's another side of the psalmist's word to us about how to live a life of persistent and steady happiness. So, how to be happy, part two, what you should do. After the psalmist begins telling us what not to do, he gives us a picture of what we should do to be happy. Come back with me, Psalm 1, verse 2. "But," contrast to the wicked, "blessed is the one whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers." Now, it would be easy for us to read those words, "whose delight is on the law of the Lord," and to think that what he's saying is, all right, so to be happy is what I've got to do is find all the bits in the Bible that are laws and just read those over and over again. You know, all the bits, you know, like in Leviticus that tell you what pots you should and shouldn't use. That's not what he's saying, thank goodness. The word law here is the word Torah, which means instruction or teaching. So it's broader than just those bits of the Bible. In fact, it means the whole teaching from God. And so what is that teaching? Well, Remember that Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 are meant to be read together. And so the instruction that the happy person will meditate on over and over again is that the fact that God has installed his king and that all the world is his and that we belong to him. And that makes sense because that's the opposite to what he said not to do in verse 1 to 3. Remember 1 to 3 said, don't hang with those people who shake their fist at God and reject his king. No, rather, he's saying, look, think and behave and belong to those who know that God has set up his king over the world. And that king is Jesus. And look what happens to the person who lets the words of God, the instruction of God, the truth that Jesus is king over the world right now, look what happens to the person who lets all of that reality, that instruction, soak into their life. They're like a tree planted by streams of water. In other words, no matter what life throws at them, they'll stand. They will live. And in season, they will flourish. Notice that it doesn't say the person who knows that instruction from the Lord, they'll never have a bad time. No, the tree is there. It will cop all kinds of seasons. It will cop hail. It will cop rain. It will cop howling winds. It will cop sunshine and stillness. All of that will happen to the tree. But the tree will stand. It will never stop living. It will never stop drawing its nourishment. It will stand through all of that. And it will bear fruit. They will prosper, says the psalmist. Not externally, they're not going to get lots and lots of stuff. They will prosper spiritually. And that person, no matter what happens to them, will be happy, says the psalmist. Now, there are a few things to tease out of that we should know. Two things. Firstly, the happy life is not found in external things, but who you are. Now, this is completely counter to the culture that we live in. So it might be even hard to even hear this. See, our culture has bought the lie that our happiness is dependent on the external things that we have. You can't be happy unless you have the latest iPhone. Or you can't be happy unless you've just done the next big trip. You can't be happy unless you fill in the blank. It's no surprise that we think that because we live in a world that's saturated with advertising. And advertising, in order to sell you something, has to convince you that you need it. And the way to convince you that you need it is to tell you the way you are right now, you're not actually happy. And you go, oh, really? They go, yep, no, that's right. You're not happy. But you can be happy if you buy this. And you go, oh, I'll be happy if I buy that. Great, I'm going to buy that. Actually, we don't turn out to be happy. But the advertisers know that it works, so they'll keep going. There was that great line that Coke ran for years. Their slogan was, things go better with Coke. What things go better with Coke? That's ridiculous. That's telling you, you won't be happy. You can't get real happy. I mean, you might go okay, but things will go better if you have Coke. Right, okay, tooth decay and obesity, excellent. You see, that attitude, it affects our relationships. It erodes them, actually. It affects how we commit time to each other. If you get invited to something, do you say yes or no, a hard yes or a hard no straight away? Like if that someone invites you to something and the date's clear, you know you're not going to something else. And you know it's something you probably like. You like the person, you like the thing. Do you go, yes, I'll be there? And then you turn up? That's not the way we roll these days. There's a reason Facebook has the interested button that's between the yes and the no. Because we kind of want to go, I'd like to keep my, you know, I'd like to be able to say that I could go, but something better might come up. And after all, my happiness is dependent on me choosing the right thing to go to. So if I commit to that and something that I think will make me happier comes up, that's a crisis because I won't be as happy as I could be. The psalmist is saying there's an escape from all of that way of living. It says happiness will never come from externals, things or experiences. And we've got the testimonies of hundreds and hundreds of top celebrities, not Christians, but other celebrities and sports people who've made it to the top of the tree. They've had every experience. They've got everything. And they still go, you know what? There's no happiness at the top of all this, guys. We just want you to know. And people go, oh, no, maybe not for you, but there will be for me. No, the psalmist says, happiness comes from deep roots into living water that will feed and nourish you no matter what is going on. Jesus is King and he loves you whether you got invited to that party or not. Jesus is King and he loves you whether you feel like you're part of the in crowd or not. Jesus is King and he loves you whether you can go on the big holiday that others around you are going on or not. Happiness is not to do with our externals. The second thing to tease out of this is that our happy life is not found by chasing happiness, but by pursuing God. I don't know if you've ever noticed this. It's true all the way through the Bible. The Bible never says that you find happiness by chasing after happiness. It doesn't say, blessed is the one who chases after blessedness. No, happiness is a byproduct of something else. Even non-Christian sociologists like Hugh Mackay have written books that point out the truth of this because it's a truth that everyone can observe. No, happiness is a byproduct of doing something else. And the psalmist says, if you chase after God, if you make God your number one thing in life, then you'll get happiness. You soak in his words and his instruction. You chase after God with everything, you'll get happiness. If you chase after happiness, you won't get God and you won't get happiness either. But someone might say, but it talked about yoking. I don't want someone else to own me. I don't want to have a king over me. That implies someone else has rule over me, that they get to tell me what to do. Why would I submit myself to that? And if you're thinking that, I would respond by saying, you know what? You are yoked to something right now, whether you know it or not. You're already yoked. You're already serving someone or something else and hoping it will deliver you happiness. The question for you is, can it deliver? If you spend every spare moment worrying about what your friends think of you, you're yoked to them. If you spend every spare moment worrying about if you've got enough money to have the life you want to live, you're yoked to that. The problem with being yoked to any of those things is that they're cruel masters. They will promise so much and deliver nothing. But look what Jesus says, Matthew 11, verse 28. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. There's just one final thing to say as I finish. Everything we've talked about tonight can seem a little bit overwhelming. You know, all of this talk of not following the wicked. not thinking like the wicked or behaving like them. Of all this talk of God's judgment is going to fall, the rod of iron that will dash to pieces like pottery. All of it can seem a bit overwhelming. I mean, who of us can be like the righteous person who follows in the way of the Lord all of the time? I mean, even the great ones in the Bible didn't get it right all the time, did they? Abraham gave his wife away to strangers. Moses committed murder before he got signed up for God. The great King David was described as a murderer and an adulterer, even though he was a man after God's own heart. Goodness knows what it would have been like if he wasn't a man after God's own heart. And it doesn't get any better in the New Testament. Peter disowned Jesus. Paul put Christians to death. Well, what do we do with all that? How do we live up to this kind of standard? Well, you know, the book of Psalms is going to lay all that out for us. The book of Psalms is going to show us that David, even the greatest king, David, couldn't fulfill Psalm 1. It's going to show us that even Solomon, in all of his splendor, he couldn't fulfill Psalm 1. It's going to show us why God's people as a whole couldn't fulfill Psalm 1, and that's why they went into exile, because they chased after the way of the wicked. They left the way of God behind. But by the end of the book of Psalms, the answer is going to be the same as the one laid out here, right here at the start. Psalm 1 starts by speaking out how to be happy. Blessed are those who don't follow the way of the wicked, but who delight in the law of the Lord, the teaching of the Lord. But we need to see that Psalm 2 ends with how to be happy. We start and end Psalm 1 and 2, bookends, with how to be happy. Psalm 2 verse 12 ends, blessed are all who take refuge in him. The key to happiness is to delight in God's words, to know that he's installed King Jesus on the throne through his death and resurrection, and then to take refuge in him. He's lived the perfect Psalm 1 life in your place. And to take refuge in him means to come to him for forgiveness when we blow it. To come to him for rest and comfort. To come to him when life sucks and things are really hard. There's no refuge from him. There's only refuge in him. Happy is the one who lives all of their life in accordance with that reality.